Hey everybody, and thank you for joining us in the latest installment of the DDT Archives, giving you the very best in old school wrestling and wrestler interviews on our other show, The Indie Lounge. I am Greg, with me as always is my partner in crime, Chris. What's up, bro?
What's going on, man? How are you?
I'm fired up today, man. A lot of stuff going on, recording on this Tuesday night. It's very rare that we can record like the night before a show goes out, so it's kind of fun that we could talk about some of the things going on. But hey man, it's been a good week. We've had a lot of great interviews coming out over the next couple weeks, and even this week we had Will All Day on Monday, which was a great one, and then we have our buddy Jack Jameson, Machismo Libre, coming out on Friday. So it's going to be a fun week here on the DDT Archives. How you feeling about that?
Dude, the weeks just keep getting better and better. I think, I might be a little biased here, but our content just keeps getting better, better, and stronger every time we get out there and do it. And, lately we might be the hardest working podcast in the country.
That's not far off. You know, we got a lot going on, so it's nice to stay busy in this time of craziness, but it's been a fun experience so far. We just hope to keep this train rolling because it is going fast and we're enjoying every second of it. So just a preview kind of coming up, what's going on next week. Next week is going to be our women's week. So why don't you talk about some of the guests we're going to have on next week for our featuring the great women of independent wrestling.
So we're looking forward to releasing a couple of great podcasts. Kylan King, who is Team 3D trained down in Florida. I flew that one solo. So it's a little close to my heart. It was a little bit different. We had a whole lot of fun recording with her. We also have Bryn Thorne out of Arizona. And, if we get a little crazy, we might release a third that week. And that would be Heather Monroe, who is by far one of the top level independent women's wrestlers in the world today. She is fantastic. The Killer Bay.
Absolutely. She was a great interview and a lot of fun to have on. We talked about a lot of different stuff with her. And then as well as on our flagship show, we'll keep the theme going. We're going to do a salute to Medusa, also known as Alundra Blaze, WWE Hall of Famer, a trailblazer for the women's wrestling movement. So, we're keeping that theme there and keeping what's everything going. It's been a wild ride so far the last month or so, and we want to thank everybody who's jumped on board and stayed with us, and that you're spreading the word and it's showing, so we really appreciate that moving forward. Before we get rolling on our show today, where we will cover NWA Clash of the Champions 6 Raging Cajun, which is a interesting show to say the least. I do want to touch on our thoughts and our prayers out to Shad Gaspard's family. That's just an absolute nightmare and a story that kicks you in the gut, as we're both beachgoers and it could happen to any one of us. So it's just absolutely heartbreaking, man, right?
Yeah, absolutely, man. I'm praying for a miracle.
Yeah.
It's one of those things, man. You want to hold out hope as long as you can, but our thoughts are definitely with the family and his friends. It's got to be a really, really tough time for everybody.
Absolutely. So definitely dedicating this one to them. But on a more positive note, we're going to cover some old school NWA, WCW, if you will, with Clash of the Champions 6, Raging Cajun. This one is probably best well known as being Flair Steamboat 2, right?
Correct.
So their epic trilogy they had in the first half of 1989, that started at the Chi-Town Rumble, it ended at WrestleWar 89, I believe, and in the middle is the second match they had here at Clash of the Champions, Raging Cajun. And a lot of the times we do these old pay-per-views or old big event shows, and I hadn't seen them. I watched this back in the day in one of our old, iterations of this podcast. I think I watched this when we did our Ultimate Clash card while I was doing the research for that one, and I watched this whole show. So it wasn't completely new to me, but when I did kind of my deep dive research on it. It is a very interesting show. What do you remember about this one in particular before we get rolling?
I mean, some of the biggest things that stand out to me are some of the best matches outside of Flair Steamboat are left off the television version of it. So you have your Sting match, you have your Lex Luger match. Those are both dark at the end of the show. And then the network obviously eliminates three of the matches as well. So it's almost like you have a second card on the same show, like just separate. It was fun old school wrestling. There's a lot of meat on the bone, even with it just being that whole five match card.
For sure. And it took place on April 2nd, 1989. It was at the Superdome in New Orleans, Louisiana. So think about all the great things that have happened in that arena. Like, the Superdome is a major league venue for anything. It's Super Bowls. It's how held WrestleManias, the Monday Nitros, when they're selling it out back in the heyday at WCW. But this one in particular, they only had 900 tickets sold at the start, like before the show. And they gave away thousands just to fill in the seats to get like 5,000 people there. So it's a really weird atmosphere. And it might have something to do with the fact that it took place on the same day as WrestleMania 5. And that, for you may not know, is, maybe do know, is that's when the Mega Powers exploded. That was Hogan versus Savage in their epic showdown as the breakdown of the Mega Powers. So when you think about it, I guess their first mistake was having it on the same day, putting it against Mania, you know, because it's an established, WrestleMania is established right now. You have a big main event with two of probably the biggest stars in the industry outside of Ric Flair going head to head, and a fantastic story behind it. It's kind of crazy that like they would try and go heads up with the WWF on this day, right?
So, I mean, the backstory there is the WWF and the NWA were going back and forth doing this to each other. So it just kind of became the norm of the time to throw out that second event. And the other piece is the NWA is a Southern promotion at that time. It is just straight up Southern wrestling versus the WWE, or WWF at the time, which is larger than life characters and superheroes. So they do draw two very different audiences, but at the same time, they clearly picked the wrong venue to hold this.
Yeah,
I would have gone more of where you know you're going to draw the crowd, whether that's Greensboro, Charlotte, Atlanta,
Baltimore,
something like
that,
rather than going to the Superdome. Because look, not for anything, the Superdome holds too many seats for you to take that risk.
And it's,
I mean, it's very, it can be very clear very quickly that it is not a sold out venue in a building that big.
And it's also, you can tell from the crowd that a lot of people were not entirely as into it as you would hope. This is kind of a show that's almost cursed by its own hubris to think they can go heads up with WrestleMania. Because on the other piece, it's on TBS. So anybody who has cable they're probably home watching WrestleMania anyway. So you have this show that's on regular TV. You're already home watching WrestleMania. So why am I going to go out to an arena in New Orleans and go see this show? And the other thing that struck me is this, because I went back and I watched some of the beauty of this too, is that they've posted all these old WCW shows on the network now. I'm not talking just Clash of Champions, but like the TV leading up to it. And I went back and I went through some of them, and there is absolutely no build for anything on this show. There's no advertising. There's no real stories going in. Steamboat's the champ. He's challenging everybody. They have a promo on him, and he's talking about Lex Luger and Rick Steiner and all these guys. And it's like, well, what about Ric Flair? And now Ric Flair's cutting promos, just literally calling out Steamboat. But then on the flip side, he's talking about Lex Luger too. There's no correlation to what they're building to here. And there's no talk of the stipulation. We get a 2 out of 3 falls match. They don't mention that till the show started. Like, I went back and checked. There's no advertising for any of this. And it's just, to them, it's just another rematch. And it's almost like they thought the carryover from Chi-Town Rumble would lead into this big thing. And it just wasn't the case. And it's just an example of how Vince McMahon is moving in on their territory. There's no questioning that, right? So there, it's just that clear example of they're focusing way too much on what the WWF is doing instead of just let's focus on what we're doing and put together a decent television special, because it had the bones. It just wasn't there.
So I don't know how much was hubris, how much was just bad business. But I mean, clearly it wasn't as effective, but there's a reason why WCW didn't, or NWA at that point, didn't turn a profit for until late 90s. But this, the way they booked the 2 out of 3 falls and not telling the crowd, it's not like that's not a NWA WCW move. Think about the Starcade where you had Hogan versus Piper. Piper pinned him. You expected him to get the belt, and then you find out it was a non-title match.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they are notorious for doing stuff like this. You know, it's a shame, because I bet you could have drawn a bigger audience by advertising that it's Flair Steamboat 2 out of 3 falls.
Yeah, it's really very vague when you watch it back, just the television shows leading up to it. It's very, very vague. So, you ready to get rolling on this? Anything before we get into the show?
No, let's go, man.
All right. So, we got a great announce team for this one. It's Jim Ross, good old JR, and Michael P.S. Hayes of the Freebirds on the broadcast. So, Jim Ross even says that it's a 10-match card. And as you alluded to earlier, their 3 matches are edited out of the network production for some reason. And then there were 2 other dark matches after the main event. I'll talk about the matches in between when we get there. But the 2 dark matches after the main event were Sting against Rip Morgan for the TV title and Lex Luger versus Jack Victory for the U.S. title. They would both win by submission to retain their titles. But the horrible thing, and I think I wrote it down in my notes for the main event, Jim Ross is constantly talking about how they're running out of time and they don't think they're going to get to these matches. So that's another instance of just poor planning. When you have a broadcast or cable broadcast show and you have time constraints, don't you think they would have mapped the show out better to have 2 of your biggest stars in title matches on the show?
Especially advertising. One of the first things he said when he's talking to the 10-match card is 5 titles will be on the line tonight.
Yeah.
Like Clash of the Champions.
See, that's the thing too. It's I can get over the network taking 3 matches out. One of them I was disappointed in, the other 2 I really didn't give a crap. But like that's baffling to me that you could have 2, those are major titles, and they're just completely off television. So,
not for anything. I didn't need to see JYD Butch Reed.
No,
I didn't need Muta. I love watching Muta, but I didn't need him over Steve Casey. I would have much rather seen the title matches, but
yeah,
you know, it's that carny atmosphere around the NWA at that time that, you know, it was let's bait and switch.
Yep. Oh, for sure. Absolutely. So the show really kicks off after JR's intro. They show this there's a video of the banquet honoring, you know, all the great legends of the NWA. They did this a lot. They did this with what was the shows they used? Slamboree used to do this. It was like what was it called? Do you remember? It wasn't like a Hall of Fame, but it was kind of like that. Like the reunions or something.
They used to do like the reunion of champions or something like that. They did it They definitely used to do it at Slamboree.
Yeah.
You know, because there was the big one where Andre showed up late, right before he died. He was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was like his last television appearance.
So it's just funny seeing like Ricky Steamboat sitting with like Luthez and all these guys, but it's just a kind of a cool little nod to all the champions of NWA pass. So our card kicks off with the tag match. It's a pretty good one. It saw the Samoan SWAT team consisting of Samu and Fatu with Paul Heyman as their manager against the Midnight Express, which is Stan Lane and Bobby Eaton with Jim Cornette. And it was a pretty good tag match, man. What were your thoughts about this one?
So I think the Samoan SWAT team is one of the more underrated tag teams of all time. They did really good work. You know, they played their gimmick really well. They came off like that savage heel tag team. And the Midnight Express are just the Midnight Express.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to build this as the phone versus the racket, because you had Paul Heyman versus Jim Cornette.
Well, that really was the feud. It wasn't between the two teams. The feud was really between Cornette and Paul E. Dangerously, because Paul E. bought the name the original Midnight Express. And that's kind of sparked the feud for these guys.
But he also had the original Midnight Express.
Of course.
And then, now can you name them?
No, I know. And it's just so funny, because you look at, as you talked about the Samoan SWAT team, you know, Fatu, who would later, you know, be more well known as he's have a Hall of Fame career as Rikishi. He's 23 years old here. He's a baby, and he's in a prime spot, kicking off a major show in a really good tag team. So it just shows like people kind of forget like the longevity of his career. Really, he was around, but it's one of those guys that was just always around.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's always good. So, and it's funny too, because Michael Hayes is, you can tell they're taking, and that's the best part, is they're constantly taking shots at the WWF and WrestleMania in the commentary, him and JR. He's talking about how, Michael Hayes talking about how this is real wrestling and not an entertainment show. And you just know, knowing what's going on at the same time as the show, it gives you a nice little chuckle. The match went about 20 minutes and it was pretty strong. You know, it's the young tag team of the SST against the seasoned vets of the Midnight Express. And the finish came when Cornette and Paulie get up on the apron. Eaton had Samu pinned, but Fatu came in and hit him with Paulie Dangerously's Zach Morris phone. The ref was, of course, distracted, and Samu rolls him over and gets the pin, and the Samoan SWAT team win. So what were your overall thoughts about this match, man?
I thought it was a pretty solid match for 1989. I thought it was well done. I thought there was definitely consistency within the storyline, which is really important. You know, you have, you know, obviously the overarching storyline of the original Midnight Express, Randy Rose and Dennis Condrey with Paulie Dangerously, and then you have the new Midnight Express with Cornette, and it just, the use of the phone fits perfectly. You didn't need the Midnight Express getting pinned clean, but it furthered that storyline. Like, Paulie needs his comeuppance. And so I definitely enjoyed that part. Now I'm going to ask you, I'm going to segue to our other show.
Sure.
Indie Lounge.
Okay.
So when we talk about the telephone versus the racket, what is the best prop you've seen used at an indie show?
Personally?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I haven't been to an indie show in so long.
We're going to fix that, for the record.
Yeah, we're going to fix that. But it's been a really long time, so I can't even play. Oh, I don't even know how to answer that. What's yours?
The computer for Brawley's manager.
Okay.
ECW.
The computer.
A laptop.
Oh, okay.
But it was like old school laptop, so it was like 3 inches thick.
Oh, it's like an old Dell.
Yep, exactly. Might as well have been a modem at that point.
Okay, what's the best prop overall for you?
Ever?
Yeah.
Oh man, that's hard.
Yeah. I mean, just off the top of my head, I would say the Undertaker's Urn. Yeah. And
New Jack's Guitar.
Huh. That's a good one.
Watching that baby powder fly when he hit somebody with it. I absolutely loved it.
That's a good one. We'll leave that at that. No sense topping that. So moving on, the next match saw the newly debuted Great Muta with his manager Gary Hart in a squash match against Stephen Casey. So I know you're a huge Muta fan, and as am I, as I've hung out with you over the years, I've grown a great appreciation for Muta. So he had debuted on WCW TV on March 18th, which is a couple weeks before this, had a few enhancement matches leading up to this one. And Stephen Casey is basically, he looks like Lex Luger's stunt double. I don't know if you remember the movie Spaceballs, when the bad guys think they captured our heroes and it turns out it's their stunt doubles. That's what Stephen Casey looks like. He looks like Lex Luger's like horrible stunt double. But I just absolutely loved the air of mystery that was around Muta at this time. He's three matches in. JR does a great job of acting freaked out by him and some of his antics in the ring. So what were your memories of Muta maybe this early on?
All right, so you ready to be mind blown, Greg?
I'm always ready to be mind blown, bro. Like, this is our thing.
When Muta was brought in, Gary Hart visioned him as a face, as a character that the kids would love. The colorful, creative, face paint. He truly saw him as a face.
Which makes a good. But that makes sense because obviously his move set would and his look would almost dictate that, because I think kids would be in like awe of what he was doing because nobody else was doing it.
Absolutely. And the use of the mist. Like that is the first time I really remember the mist being used. I'm sure I saw Killer Khan use it at some point, but it doesn't resonate with me. Muta and the Mist, and that's actually my biggest issue with this match, is in my eyes, Steve Casey no-sold the Mist entirely too much. Like, that is supposed to be blinding you.
Do you think it was a mistake? And I know we don't like to go into like fantasy booking and things like that, but like it kicked off the match. Was it like just too early to do it?
No, I would have come in. I would have done it. I would have hit the finisher. End of match.
Yeah.
You know what? Everybody sees that and goes, what is that? What's in that green mist? How did that just happen? Because to me, Steve Casey didn't do a favor to anybody that follows on later on and gets misted and sells it immediately. You've kind of taken away from it a little bit.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, just at least on our show, we're such big fans of logic and things making sense. And you pull up a great point there. I really didn't notice like him underselling it at all. I just thought it was too quick and early in the match. But maybe that was just me.
And listen, that makes sense too. I just think this is his third time out. His first time on major television, that makes a huge statement. Not to mention that maybe you take less time off the card and all of a sudden you can get another match on.
Yeah.
And you've done the exact same thing.
Oh, for sure. But it really does, besides that, it does do a nice job of building up his character, at least. I think JR does what JR does. And he's always talked about this all the time, that it's his job to get guys over. And he really does a fantastic job, especially in this match, especially it stood out to that air of mysticism when it came to the Great Muta and what he was bringing to the table. And did you catch that at all? Did you notice that?
I did. And the other thing that stood out in commentary for me was just the language used wouldn't fly today. There are a ton of use of Oriental, and it wouldn't go down like that today. But yeah, there was definitely, he built up that mystique, you know, and just kind of, to me at the time, I don't want people to misunderstand. I have grown to absolutely love Muda's work. I hated Muda as a kid for what he used to do to Sting. I hated him. Yeah. But that's what I was supposed to do. I was supposed to hate him. So he did exactly what he was supposed to do. For a guy, he's a decent size. He's not overly big, but he comes off larger than life. You know, that whole, the face paint and the entire face paint. So you have no idea what he looks like under that paint. And that to me is always fascinating, because even looking at like the Road Warriors or Sting and the Crow is different, but if you grew up watching Sting, you knew who he was without paint. You know, same thing with the Road Warriors. Muda, not so much. That whole thing was covered at all times. And he had that great 90s mushroom haircut.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. And we always talk about this on the show, about guys that are ahead of their time. And Muda very, very well was ahead of his time. And, you know, think about how he wins the match. He wins the match with the moonsault. They, like, off the top turnbuckle. They don't even call it that. That's how innovative that move was at the time in 1989. It doesn't have a name yet. Now it's like you see 20 a match. But, like, then it was like, whoa, what the hell is that? So that's why it's always cool to go back and watch some of these old shows, because it almost, you get to see the evolution of some of these moves that we may take for granted in 2020, where in 1989 it literally blew your face off.
Yeah, he's just fantastic.
And that's the other thing too, is Michael Hayes. Talk about putting over not just a wrestler, but putting over their finish. Michael Hayes clearly states he's the only performer in the world that does this. Like, talk about putting over a single move like that. Like that's great how they did that. And then here's where things get a little weird in this pay-per-view after this match. So now we have JYD, Junkyard Dog, against Hacksaw Butch Reed with his manager Hiro Matsuda. This match went on, just didn't need 10 minutes for this match at all. JYD comes down to the ring with either the worst mic'd up or the actual worst Dixieland jazz marching band I've ever seen. It's pretty terrible. And then during this match, they're taking more cheap shots at WWF. They're saying hi to fans in Connecticut while plugging an event in New Haven. They say especially in Stanford. So they're really going hard up on the WWF bashing, even ever so subtly or not so subtly. But it's just, you know what's funny about that too, is both of those guys are so integral into the history and the success that WWF would have in the 90s, that it's funny to hear like them comment on it in such a negative light in 1989, right?
Well, I mean, it's funnier that they have the washed up wrestlers from WrestleMania 3 as they're bad mouthing. And listen, I am not going to undersell the contributions of JYD or Butch Reed. They both did some great work. I love Butch Reed as part of Doom. As everybody knows, I'm a big guy. Love tag team wrestling. But his solo career outside of Florida really wasn't anything special. JYD at this point is a little bit past his prime. You know, JYD in his prime, really, that was Mid-South. That wasn't even in the WWF.
Yeah.
So to me, like, this match especially, it started bad with the marching band, and it didn't get better, unfortunately. Again, for two guys that had talent in the business, and
that were trailblazers, really,
JYD was one of the most over people in the South at one point, which if you think about the history, that's crazy.
Yeah, this it's, you know, like, remarkable.
You're talking about during a time when it was acceptable to walk around with the Confederate flag draped on your robe, calling yourself wild-eyed Southern boys, and, you know, talking about the Freebirds and stuff. And he still was at the top of his game, and everyone loved him. And they consistently looked for that next guy to replace him. And until Ron Simmons comes in, I really don't think anybody did.
Yeah.
So that's always interesting. But again, it would be real easy to sit here and just absolutely bash the match itself. But that's not what we're here for. No. You know, like, again, they're two.
If you're familiar with these two guys, especially in this era, it's a pretty standard match for the two of them. It's not terrible. It's not good, but it's just what you expect from a match between these two guys in 1989. So there's yeah, like you said, there's really no sense in bashing this match at all. It is what it is. So then we get into the matches that are skipped on the network. So they show a coming up image of Dick Murdoch dropping an elbow on somebody, but it skips his match with Bob Orton, which Bob Orton would win. The next two matches are also not included on the network. The next one being the one that I wish we were able to see, which was the Varsity Club defeating the Road Warriors for the NWA World Tag Titles. And the Varsity Club was Mike Rotunda and Dr. Death Steve Williams. That just pissed me the hell off for sure that match was skipped, right?
That was, I mean, I don't remember. I'm not going to pretend to remember from 1989. But I'm sure it was a great match.
But that's the thing. It was a big story, too.
Underrated stables of all time.
Yeah, and it was a big storyline, too, because the Warriors got screwed by the ref, Teddy Long, who refused to count a pinfall, and then right after that did a fast count when Dr. Death pinned Hawk. So then, and that is what transitioned Teddy Long into being a manager. So he got fired as a referee. And went on to become a great heel manager. And he would manage, you know, most notably the aforementioned Doom, which was Ron Simmons and Butch Reed. He managed Johnny B. Badd, the Skyscrapers with Dan Spivey and Mean Mark Callis, who would later become the Undertaker.
So the Skyscrapers are first, I believe.
Yeah, I wasn't going in order. I was just, you know, kind of naming off.
No, but I'm saying, like, I'm pretty sure he immediately brings in the Skyscrapers to go toe-to-toe with the Road Warriors.
Yeah, because that was the short run for Mark Callis there too, though, because it's 89, it's mid 89 already. He debuts in late 90, so
yeah, but also it transitions to being Sid Vicious too.
Yeah.
So the other piece with this, you know, the Varsity Club are definitely an underrated faction. I think because a lot of people didn't see it, they don't realize how solid they were. But they could have legitimately walked away in this event with all of the tag team titles in the company. Because later on, you're going to see the Varsity Club of Kevin Sullivan and who else was
he? Dan Spivey.
Dan Spivey went for the U.S. tag titles. So, I mean, they could have walked away with all the gold.
Yeah, and we'll get into that match now, actually, because, you know, we're going to skip right over the Iron Sheik versus Ranger Ross, which was thankfully we were blessed not having that one on the network feed, so we don't have to talk about that. But yeah, the next match after that, is, as you said, was for the U.S. tag team titles. It saw the First Family, which was Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert and Rick Steiner with Missy Hyatt as their manager, against the Varsity Club, which was Kevin Sullivan and Dan Spivey. Spivey had just come in to join the Varsity Club a few weeks prior, and Gilbert and Steiner had just won the tag titles, the U.S. tag titles, from Kevin Sullivan and Dr. Death back in February, and we're here in the first week in April. So this match was fun. It's kind of all over the place, but there's a lot of talent in the ring here, and I enjoyed it. So what were your thoughts about it?
I really enjoyed it. I loved watching Eddie Gilbert back in the day. His colorful attire, his speed and agility in the ring. At the time, it was really revolutionary in a lot of ways. There was no way not to enjoy it as a kid. And Rick Steiner had just left the Varsity Club. you know, it was an opportunity for him to really kind of grow. You know, obviously that tag team is not the same as the Steiner brothers. Let's not pretend. But at the same time, Eddie Gilbert was over. You know, he was so good and gone way too early. But just super, super talented. And the match itself was all over the place. But it was a good, fun, exciting match that people could really sink their teeth into and just kind of enjoy. Sit back and enjoy. It wasn't a psychological thriller. It was just a good, solid match.
Yeah, and like you said, it wasn't a derogatory all over the place. I know that can kind of be construed with that, but it really wasn't. This match was a lot of fun. It had a lot going on. The one thing that stood out to me is that crazy bump Rick Steiner took on a flying clothesline on Spivey, where he cleared the ropes and went straight onto the floor. I jumped out of my chair. I was totally, go back and watch that. Just watch that match and watch that one move, because it'll make you just shake, because just the athleticism of Rick Steiner by itself.
Very underrated athleticism with Rick Steiner. I think people really thought they bought into that dog face gremlin character. And I think he's a guy another one that doesn't get the respect that he deserves in the business.
Yeah. And this match in particular it's right on the cusp of the Steiner brothers. Scott's here. He really debuted at Chi-Town Rumble, and you know, we're getting there to the point where the brothers first team up in WCW, NWA, and go on to be one of the greatest tag teams of all time. So it's kind of cool to see like just the towards the end of his not Rick Steiner not being with Scott. But the finish came right after Eddie Gilbert hit Kevin Sullivan with Missy Hyatt's Gucci purse, and there was enough to retain the title. So I think the one thing that I could critique about this match, it was maybe a little too short. There's a lot of talent in that ring. I think they could have gone maybe a little bit longer. But I was enjoying it so much, and then it just kind of ended, and I don't like it when...
I don't think they could have, though. I think they were close to that TV time.
And
you remember, you still have 2 out of 3 falls with Flair and Steamboat.
Yeah, that's
it. You're cutting time.
Yeah, and that's it. That's like that goes back to what we were saying. It's just kind of it sucks that they didn't plan this out well enough to give things ample time, because this is the last match before the main event, and they allude to them, and JR talks about it before they get to the main event. Is he talks about them moving the Lex Luger Jack Victory match to after it. And if there is ample time, that they'll see it on the network or on the broadcast. If not, it'll be on WCW Saturday Night the following Saturday. It's just kind of nuts. So
the one thing I'll say with that, I wonder if they did that to get eyes on their TV on Saturday night.
That's a great point.
You know, like they purposely said, let's put these two title matches on TV and let's draw an audience there.
No, that's a great point. I didn't think of it that way, but you know, I'm glad they did give ample time to the main event, because it is a classic, and you have Ric Flair versus Ricky the Dragon Steamboat for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. 2 out of 3 falls. They go 55 minutes, and it's a tremendously classic match, a quote unquote Meltzer 5-star match, you know, if that's something you care about, but it holds up in 2020, 31 years later. So before we kind of get into the particulars of this match, what were your thoughts going in? Because obviously I think you've seen this before. I've seen this match before.
Yeah, I've seen the trilogy a lot. I love this trilogy. It's my favorite trilogy. Mm-hmm. I think
the reason we've never covered it really is because it's been done so many times. It's kind of not worth it for us to do all three matches. But going back to earlier, I just wanted to just get off the beaten path. You know, if you listen to the Indie Lounge, you love our tangents. But, you know, as we like to do our rivalry shows, I think going back to doing a Sting Muda show would be a lot of fun.
definitely
for doing our rivalry shows. But I digress. So go on. What were your thoughts going in and rewatching this one?
You know, it's the ultimate good guy versus bad guy. It's the family man versus the Lothario. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, rich versus working class. Like, it was everything that was wrestling at that time. And the best part about it was both of them could go. Like, there was never any doubt.
Talk about two guys that are legends in their prime. And maybe, and I don't even think this is, maybe it's towards the end of Flair's really prime years. Because when you get into the 90s, you know, he starts that wear and tear. And when he goes to WWF, and it's maybe not the same. But he's as good as he ever was in this match. And Steamboat's just at the top of his game, for sure. You know, I love, like, their entrances. The laser name effects on the board that have Rick with a K. And then they ran out of, I guess they paid by the letter, because the dragon just says the Drago. Did you notice that at all?
I didn't notice that, and I'm mad at myself for not catching it.
It's pretty funny. Like, this late 80s laser effects on the board behind them. So, of course, you know, Steamboat comes out with his kid dressed as a dragon, and his wife is there, wife at the time. But they don't mention the stipulation for this match until the entrances. I went back and I checked. They do not say this is a 2 out of 3 falls match until they're on the way to the ring, which is kind of hilarious to me. And then also, Terry Funk joins the broadcast. Michael Hayes is out. Terry Funk is here. He was at the banquet honoring the old NWA champions, and he's here to call the match with JR, and does a pretty good job, too. You know, a couple things that stood out to me before we get to the first fall. There's a pinning predicament on the, like, close to the ropes. Tommy Young, the referee, jumps out of the ring to count the pin. I've never seen that before, like, before this match. Like, it's crazy. And, you know, what's great about it is Steamboat really dominated the first 20 minutes of this match. Handedly. And it just shows that he's working like a world champion here. He's not the underdog against the legendary Ric Flair. He is working as, he is the world champion. He's on the attack. And it's Flair's ability to sell. And he legitimately has no offense in the first 20 minutes of this match. But it's Flair's ability to take a beating and sell and wince in pain and beg for mercy. And when you talk about the greats of all time, it's always, you know, it's always those guys in their era, right? It's the Rock and Austin. Who is better? For Flair, it's always Flair and Hogan, really, when they talk about the two guys that are on opposite sides forever. And it's his ability to sell without that offense and make the other guy look like a champion. That's what separated him from Hulk Hogan in terms of greatness. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I agree fully. I don't think you can. I can't recall a single Ric Flair match where he was dominant offensively in a title match ever. Regardless of if he was, you know, the going in champ or leaving champ, mm-hmm. He was the dirtiest player in the game. He found a way to win. Yeah. A very, very rarely was he dominant all the way through.
Yeah, because
he was so good at selling.
And that's the thing, is you talk about nowadays, like John Cena's 5 moves of doom. Flair had a chop and the figure four. That's it. And a good punch. But that's it.
And he would get thrown off the top rope.
Yeah. But you can probably name the moves that he, you know, every Flair match has the formula. This kind of breaks away from it a little bit. But you can probably name all the moves he takes, like the back body drops, the thrown off the top rope, stuff like that. More than his offense. And that's not a knock on him. It just shows how great he really was, where he's a legend without having those big moves and those big spots. But that just, and also he gets the first fall. He gets completely obliterated in the first 20 minutes of this match. And he gets the first fall on a reverse inside cradle. And it's just brilliant storytelling, to break down this match into the three parts. And, So before we get into the next phase of this match, how'd you feel about the first 20 minutes or so as we headed to the first fall?
It was strong. It was a quality match. It was Steamboat on offense, Flair doing what he does best in selling. And, you know, it's a great example of what pro wrestling used to be.
Yeah, and Flair's playing that the weasel heel to the point where he's always able to get out of trouble. Steamboat's given him everything he's got. And you really see that maybe after the second fall that, and I love logic and storytelling in wrestling. I say it all the time ad nauseum on this podcast. But it's almost like you can see Flair's strategy unfold as the match goes on, that he knows he's going to let Steamboat work himself to death, wear himself out in the first 20 minutes. Hey, I'm going to steal a fall here. Then in the second fall, it comes when Steamboat superplexes Flair and he just repeatedly pounds on Flair's back with heavy forearm shots, gets him in a double chicken wing, and Flair's smart enough to submit early, quickly in that, just to get out of the hold. And the fall came around the 35-minute mark of this match. Get out of the hold, and now you see, after the second fall, it's 1-1. Now it starts to turn around. Now Flair goes on the offensive, and he starts working the legs, and he starts setting him up for the figure four. And it's brilliant. And that's what makes this match so special. So, you know, getting into that sequence of the second fall was pretty cool, though, in my opinion. How about you?
I love the double chicken wing. I thought it was such a creative way to get him to submit. But the psychology of tapping quick, because it is 2 out of 3 falls, is huge. And it's something that you don't necessarily see in 2 out of 3 falls matches today. But it's just, it's good strategy. Why would I want to get hurt more?
Yeah.
The minute I tap, the ref's going to make them break the hold.
Exactly. And also, it's like, I already have one up on him. Mm-hmm. It's really not affecting me. But the other thing I noticed too, as we move towards the climax of this match, because the last 20 minutes of this match is just, it could have been just a regular match in and of itself. But, you know, Flair wasn't really working a heel style in this match. Did you take that away from it? Or was it just a kind of standard Flair thing, but I just felt he wasn't as sinister as he usually is in seeing hundreds of Ric Flair matches in my lifetime.
Yeah, he wasn't as sinister as he had been at other times. However, it's a different psychology and different type of match. But at the same time, that Flair, you know, story is always the same. Yeah. You know, there wasn't the complete and total, you know, disregard for rules in this one. But I think that was the story they wanted to tell. I think they wanted it to be the best wrestler in 2 out of 3 falls. I'd almost equate it to like the Randy Orton Edge stuff that's going on right now, where, when Randy Orton last night said to Charlie Caruso, "Do you not know what a wrestling match is?" Like, wrestling, it's what we do.
Yeah.
Well, that's what this was all about. It was just straight up, you know, it was clear, even though they couldn't be two more different people, there was a ton of respect for both of them.
Oh, for sure. And I think the other thing is the crowd here that I did notice as the match went on and on and on was, when you think about, you have 900 paid fans, you gave away thousands of tickets, like 4,000 some odd tickets. A lot of those people that are getting free tickets maybe don't really give a shit about Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, and they know Ric Flair. So the crowd does seem to be a little bit split, in my opinion, just going off what I saw. And you could see it as the match went on. And it begged the question to me was, and I didn't watch this much back then. I was, 8 and 7 years old when this match took place, but was Steamboat really a marketable ticket selling champion? As great as he is in the ring, did he have that extra that over the top popularity, because babyface champions are always hard anyway. You know, they're the hardest thing to sell.
I don't know, because this is also real close to when he came back over.
Yeah,
you know, from the WWF, and he wasn't billed as a top guy in the WWF. He was the Intercontinental champ for a good run, but that's the working man's title. That's not top of the game. So you can legitimately make that argument. You know, he's another guy that might have been a little bit before his time. You know, like today he would be the ideal champ. You know, like has enough size that it's believable, has enough athleticism that he's great. You know, like it's just a different thing. And I don't know. He's also not the typical Southern draw.
Yeah, but he's not the over the top. He doesn't have that over the top charismatic personality either. He's kind of like this, you know, like the quote unquote white meat baby face. And, you know, if you're a young guy in the South watching wrestling, you know, I'm just thinking like teenage me, like being married and being a family man is not as cool as riding in jets, having a different woman every night, partying in the best clubs, wearing the nicest clothes. It's kind of hard to be like, why would you cheer for him outside of his pure wrestling ability? You know, like, it's just,
fair argument.
It's almost like, you know, I thought of this and I didn't write it down, but you know, now thinking about it, I remembered it. You know how like when they talk about bad wrestlers, it's just like, oh, the guy had a great look, great personality, and then the bell rang. Steamboat's almost the opposite of that, where I can't wait for the bell to ring, because before and after, it's like it doesn't leave much to you, but in between those ropes, man, he's as good as anybody who's ever done it.
Oh, without a doubt.
So
that's a good way to put it.
So, you know, moving forward with this match, how it ended, you know, the final fall comes. Steamboat's got Flair in the double chicken wing again, but after, you know, Flair had worked his leg to set him up for the figure four the entire last third of this match, Steamboat's leg gives out and they fall backwards. But he still got Flair's shoulder to the mat, and his shoulders are also on the mat. And Tommy Young counts to three. And then Flair's foot is clearly under the ropes, and Tommy Young doesn't see it. And both guys' shoulders were down. So the bell rings. And at 55 minutes, you know, there's, you know, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat retains the World Heavyweight Championship to a lot of controversy. So, you know, looking back on that, which is the best of the three, really?
I love this one.
This
to
one,
be honest, this one was. I really felt, because there was no transition into the Funk Flair feud after the next one. To me, that kind of took away from that match a little bit. Like, it took the spotlight off that match and onto what happened after that match. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed this one. The finish was exactly what it needed to be in order to justify another title match. At the end of the day, like, that's what it is. Like, yeah, they were trying to establish Steamboat as a champion, but also want to get that title back on Flair. How are you going to do that?
And also it makes sense too, because you want people to pay money for your big title matches on pay-per-view. And this is obviously, you can have like a schmazzy finish or controversial finish on a just regular cable TV broadcast to get to feed into that next match coming up. So wait, I don't remember. So I'm going to ask you, because you would, because I remember watching it. So like, Funk attacked Flair at WrestleWar right after their third match. That's what you're talking about, right?
Correct.
So
that's why Funk started on commentary in this one.
Yeah.
On commentary there at the pay-per-view as well. And then he comes in and, I respect you, Ric Flair. You know, I just want a shot at you, Ric Flair. Just please, Ric Flair. And Flair's like, where have you been the last 10 years? You left the business to go do your deal. Please, Ric, will you just give me a title shot? And it ends with a pile driver on a table.
So Is Flair kind of becoming a good guy at this point?
Yeah.
So it makes sense that he was kind of in the middle on this match right?
He was always in the middle, though.
Right, like, that's what I was going to say.
Not as cleanly as he was now, but he was the cool heel. So that there is no bigger middle ground.
Yeah. He was, because he was the same whatever he did. It was just a matter of, you know, who he surrounded himself with.
And, well, I mean, Yamasaki Corporation with Butch Reed.
Whatever. but, you know, just to kind of wrap this up, you know, these matches between, especially the three of them, the trilogy between Flair and Steamboat, just to put the final bow on it, it sets a certain bar because it's become part of wrestling vocabulary. When people talk about like a good match or something like that, it's just, well, it's not Flair Steamboat, but it's good. And everyone knows what you're talking about because those matches are that legendary. It's become a part of pro wrestling vernacular and they hold up, man. Like that's the other thing. It's sometimes we look back on these matches that were these big events back in the late '80s, early '90s, even through the, and all the way through the Attitude Era and the Monday Night Wars. And it's kind of like, they were exciting at the time, but looking back, it's kind of like, you kind of like, I don't know about this. And you look at those through rose colored glasses. You look at them as a teenager, like these matches, they hold up. These are absolute clinics, hands down. And it's just amazing wrestling by two all-time greats in their prime, as I said before.
It was a fun show. Again, there's some good, there's some bad, there's some confusing. But at the end of the day, the main event takes the cake and makes it worthwhile.
Yeah, exactly. And if you watch anything, you know, if you want to go back and watch this whole event, go ahead. It's incomplete. But... I mean, the two matches that I would suggest watching are the last two on the network feed because the tag match with Eddie Gilbert and Rick Steiner against the Varsity Club, it's quick, but it's good. And then it leads right into the main event. All right, man. Anything else you want to say before we head on out of here?
No, this was exciting, and I look forward to next week bringing everybody the Alundra Blaze story.
Absolutely. So we'll plug our shows moving forward. Like I said, just check out our interviews on the Indie Lounge. We've had some great ones so far and some great ones coming up. But this week in particular is Will All Day is up and available, as well as Jack Jameson coming up on Friday. And obviously you can go on iTunes, Spotify. We're on Google Podcasts and all the platforms you may want. We're there, so please check it out. Subscribe, rate the podcast. We're really working our asses off to bring you the very best content in classic wrestling and independent interviews. So go check that out for sure. Any other interviews you want people to go back and check out that we've released already? We have a lot in the can already that we're waiting to hold on to. But any in the archives that you're looking forward to?
Gonna come out really, really cocky, and I'm okay with that. There is not a bad interview in that bunch.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got a little bit of everything. You have some young guys that are fresh faced in the business that, you know, in Johnny Cove and Gray O'Ryan, and you have Will Alday, who is just absolutely unreal, just a whole nother level. Like I listen back to that and I'm just like, dude, I mean, the guy's talking about he wants his action figure to look different so kids buy it off the shelf. Like, straight up, that's a guy that gets it.
Yeah.
Like, my action figure is going to look different. Yeah. And that, to me, is fantastic. Like, that's what it's all about.
And then you look at a guy like Jaden Newman, who just brought a tremendous amount of energy and was so much fun to talk to. And I know you have the rap as the cocky one between the two of us, right or wrong?
Correct.
I was
told that by an unnamed source who told me I should probably tone it down, and I said no.
That's fine, but I am not like that, and that's okay too. It fits me. I will say proudly that I agree with you that there isn't a bad interview because they all differ and they all bring something different to the table, and that's what we're shooting for with this podcast and the Indie Lounge and everything. And the other thing that we forgot to mention, and I apologize, but we waited to the end, is we really have to thank our logo designer Spencer Barnett, who gave us our brand new logo, which I'll work on later to get it all, like, fix it so it shows up on iTunes and everything. I gotta play around with that a little bit, but he gave us a great new logo. Please check it out. This is the first step to getting our merch game going, right or wrong.
Oh, without a doubt.
So so we can't thank him enough. So huge shout out to him for helping us out with that. And like I said, next week we got it's Women's Week here on the podcast. So we got Kylan King, Bryn Thorne, our show on Medusa, and maybe a little surprise here and there moving forward. So as always, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at DDT Archives. We are on Instagram and Facebook, all at DDT Archives. Chris, your Twitter handle is?
Chris_DDTHSLB.
And like I said, thank you so much for... We've been back a month from a 2.5-year layoff. And we couldn't be more excited for where everything's headed and the growth we've shown in such a short time. And we have all of you guys to thank for that. And we couldn't be, we appreciate all the guests we've had and the support you've shown us on social media. Keep it coming, man. Spread the word. Cause we're working hard to bring you the very best content in a oversaturated market, but we're trying our best to carve out our little niche in the wall. And we're doing just that for you guys. So thank you again. And we'll see you on Friday on the Indie Lounge with Machismo Libre himself, Jack Jameson.